This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
What we were suing for is a change in policy that wouldn't let them terrorize families, organizers, or neighborhoods again.
Black Lives Matter grassroots co-founder and organizer Dr. Melina Abdullah denounces police terror tactics against her family and her community.
The history of Druid is an arm of the ruling class. It has no independence whatsoever. It helped build the Israeli state. Without the history of Druid, according to the founders of Ben-Gurion and people like that, it would be unlikely that the Israeli state would be able to get off the ground.
City University of New York professor Carol Lang exposes the Israeli histadrut.
The negotiating teams for both the amendments to the health regulations and the new pandemic treaty have failed. Neither team of negotiators has been able to come up with a document.
In a recent victory for the medical freedom movement, the World Health Organization failed to adopt a global pandemic treaty.
Well, there are zoonoses, but this one looks like another gain-of-function laboratory product. The specific strain that we're tracking looks like it came out of the USDA poultry lab in Athens, Georgia.
Dr. Peter McCullough discusses COVID, bird flu, vaccine ideology, and corruption. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio spoke to Cal State University Los Angeles Pan-African Studies professor and Black Lives Matter grassroots co-founder and organizer, Dr. Melina Abdullah. Her household was swatted by the Los Angeles Police Department's SWAT team division on three different occasions within a one-year period. However, Abdullah's recent civil lawsuit was unsuccessful. She describes the terror of those encounters and their impact on her family, neighbors, and social justice movements.
Today, our guest is Dr. Melina Abdullah. She is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Grassroots and Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. She is the professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA, as well as she was just involved in a lawsuit that we're going to be talking about today, where she was suing the Los Angeles Police Department for swatting her house. How are you, Dr. Melina Abdullah?
I am making it. Thanks for asking.
Well, just to start it off, so that people have a context for the politics of what's going on in LA. Prior to you and the Los Angeles Police Department having a run-in at your house, what kind of work do you do in the community?
My paid job is I'm a professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State LA's College of African Studies. And then I also organize with Black Lives Matter Los Angeles and Black Lives Matter Grassroots, which is our worldwide formation of Black Lives Matter chapters all around. And I know that the organizing work that I do is one of the reasons I was targeted, or the reason that I was targeted by LAPD for this swatting.
Why would you say that that was the reason you was targeted? For the people who don't know anything about COINTELPRO or anything like that, why would you link the work you were doing in the community to the Los Angeles Police Department basically terrorizing you and your family?
Well, what came out in the court case is all of this body cam footage where the sergeant who was in charge at the scene pulled up my Facebook profile. He said to himself and to others, quote, this is that Black Lives Matter chick, right? This chick is a leader in Black Lives Matter. So it was very clear that they knew who I was. And another officer, as she was coming to the scene, said, this is going to be fun. So it was clear that they intended to use what they saw as an opening to target and terrorize me. And what wasn't allowed into this case, but is part of the historic record, is the day after we announced that we were suing them for that swatting that took place in October 2020. The day after we made that a public announcement, they actually swatted me a second time, and then later in the week, swatted me a third time. So we know that it's targeting. We know that it's retaliation for trying to hold police accountable for the terror they exact in our community.
You keep using the word swatting. What exactly is swatting? And what exactly happened at your house when they showed up?
Sure. Swatting is usually a false phone call. They call it a hoax phone call that's meant to elicit really violent police response. So usually a SWAT team. In my case, the first swatting, August 2020 swatting, there was a phone call made to LAPD. A 911 call came in and said that I was being held hostage. It didn't actually name me, but it said that people at my address were being held hostage and they needed $1 million ransom or they were going to start killing people. That's what the phone call said. Now, what they knew is that phone call was a quote-unquote hoax because the 911 operator said, well, why are you doing this? And the caller said, to send a message. And then the 911 operator says, well, what message are you trying to send? And he said that BLM is a bunch of effing, and he used the R word. I don't usually use that R word, but he said a bunch of effing retards. So they knew that this was somebody who was either targeting the Black Lives Matter or more than likely it was a hoax call. And in fact, the sergeant on the way said he thought that it was a hoax call. But swatting is when someone calls in to try to get a violent police response. And in this case, the police were complicit in that response.
So you said the sergeant knew that it was a hoax call as well as the dispatcher, yet it went down two more times in the same week is what you said, right?
No. So it went down first in August 2020, and then we made an announcement of the lawsuit several months later. And the day after we made the announcement, there was a second swatting. And then another time that same week, there was a third swatting. So, yeah, it was a total of three times in the span of a year that LAPD swatted my home with myself and my children in it.
And what exactly happens inside of a swatting event when they came in with your children? How do they respond? I'm sure they don't ask you, can you please sit down and talk with us, ma'am? How does it, what actually happens?
Right. So what happened the first time, which is the time that we're talking about that the case was brought, is there were dozens of officers who surrounded my house with assault rifles. We know there was an AR-15 and there was some other kind of assault rifle loaded with slugs, which I had never heard of, but apparently it's more heavy artillery enough to go through, to blast through a building. And they surrounded my home and pointed guns at my home, helicopter overhead, and then got on the loudspeaker and announced that everyone at my address needed to come out with their hands up. So at gunpoint, I came out. I had my children kind of barricade themselves in the back room so they could be safe. People ask why I came out. Well, any mother would come out if there are guns pointed at her house because you don't want them to start shooting at your house with your children in it. So I came out at gunpoint and they kept their guns trained on me, and then I was instructed to walk to a police line and confirm that I wasn't being held hostage. All it took, apparently, was my word. They didn't check on me. They didn't check on the children. They didn't check the home. But they asked if I was being held hostage. I said, no, that was ridiculous. And then I was sent along my merry way.
So what is the process? They acknowledge that this was a hoax. What is the process to make sure that they don't do this to you or anyone else's family and somebody just gets shot in the process? I mean, is there any precautionary measure that they take to, I mean, it happened to you three times, so they can tell that somebody is habitually messing with you and your family. What are they doing about that? I mean, can you guys just be swatted again if someone just calls?
The short answer is yes. We can just be swatted again, and anybody can be swatted. I do want to clarify that the first call, there was a 911 audio tape. The second call, they claim that the caller called in on an unrecorded line. I don't know what kind of line at the police department is unrecorded, so we believe that they made the whole second call up themselves, that somebody in LAPD decided to teach me a lesson, and there is no actual swatting call, that they came out on their own. The third call, they claim that there is audio, but they won't release it, so we don't believe them on the third call either. Only the first call had an actual audio tape that was released, but they were also complicit even further that they claim that they investigated that call and they found that it was three white teens motivated by hate. That's a quote, right? Three white teens motivated by hate. Well, they didn't question those teens. They didn't arrest those teens. They didn't charge those teens. We found out in the court case last week that they didn't even tell those teens' parents on them. So these quote-unquote three white teens motivated by hate, they were never even put on punishment for almost killing me and my children. So it's really important that we lift that up, and I think that that's more evidence that LAPD was complicit. There is no, part of what we were speaking in the lawsuit was a change in policy, because we know it would have been really easy for them to simply call the house and say, hey, are you guys okay in there, right? It would have been really easy for them to knock at the door and ask if we were okay. But they chose not to do any of those things and instead, again, try to terrorize us by surrounding us with guns and forcing me out of my home at gunpoint. And I should add that in addition to my family and me, my children and me suffering through that, my neighborhood had to suffer through that. The only reason I believe I'm still standing is I went on Instagram Live as it was happening and asked people to come and to have eyes on them as this was happening. And my neighbors did come out. So there were neighbors all in the streets. And there was one neighbor in particular who met me at my front door, a brother, a black father, right? Who said, you know, if you're going to the police line, we're all going. And he put his body in front of mine and wouldn't let me walk by myself. And his wife, you know, stood to the side of me as well. And we walked down there together. And so, you know, it was my entire neighborhood who survived the ordeal, predominantly black neighborhood in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles. So what we were suing for is a change in policy that wouldn't let them terrorize families, organizers, or neighborhoods again.
So what exactly happened in the courtroom and what was the outcome?
It was really an extension of the terror that they tried to exact in the first place. So it was confirmation that all parts of this absolutely unjust criminal legal system worked together, that the judge in the case didn't allow evidence of the second and third swatting into the proceedings. He didn't allow evidence that just a couple weeks before the case went to trial, my lawyer's house was swatted. And the police, LAPD, came into his house as he was actually reviewing my case file. And they took photos of the case file. The judge didn't allow that evidence into the courtroom. The judge then blocked us from having expert testimony by Dr. Tabitha Jones-Jawazet and also expert testimony from Dr. James Taylor, who your listeners might be familiar with as an expert on Black Power organizing and how they attempted to terrorize Black Power organizers. He wouldn't allow that expert testimony to be included. We witnessed as the judge blocked out community support. So every day of the 9-day trial, the courtroom was filled with community supporters. And the second day, the judge put a lockdown on it, blocking off two rows of seating and calling in the LA County Sheriff, a dozen of them, to monitor this civil case, right? It's not even a criminal case. Locking up people's personal cell phones, not allowing journalists to have computers in the courtroom. So it was a terrible ordeal. I was berated by the city attorney who represented the police in ways I've never seen anybody ever questioned on the stand. He asked me things like, oh, you think you're special, don't you? Right? Basically calling me an uppity Negro. It was just another terrible ordeal. And I think really exposed how absolutely unjust the so-called criminal justice system can be. And the outcome was that we did not win our case. So LAPD was not found liable for anything that they did in this swatting or any other swatting.
That was J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio speaking to Cal State University Los Angeles Pan-African Studies professor and Black Lives Matter grassroots co-founder Dr. Malina Abdullah. She is currently the vice presidential running mate of presidential candidate Cornel West. You can follow J.R. Valray's work at blacknewworldmedia.com.
This watch of mine, gotta open it up, don't know who's been in it, tracking where I go, finding out all my business, secure, rough, tape, video cameras locked on me, in every dressing room, on every floor, in every store, damn, can I get that democracy and equality and privacy, you busy watching me, That you're blind, baby, you neglect to see the drugs coming into my community, weapons coming into my community, dirty cops in my community, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free, and you keep saying that I'm free, busy watching me.
That was Jill Scott, Watching Me. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The Labor Education Project on AFL-CIO International Operations held an online forum on May 4th, 2024, where City University of New York professor Carol Lang gave a presentation on the Israeli Histadrut. Although Histadrut calls itself a union and is supported by the AFL-CIO leadership, Lang says it is really not a union. She highlights the Histadrut's work to stop Jewish and Arab unity and its role in supporting the South African apartheid regime and U.S. military interventions around the world.
For me, what's important is to understand the development of the Histadrut, because the Histadrut, without the Histadrut, there would have been no Israeli state. They, unlike the AFL-CIO, which is clearly an organization that essentially has helped American imperialism and has supported American imperialism for its entire existence. Without the Histadrut, there wouldn't have been an Israeli state. And the fact is, it's not a trade union. And as much as Schuller, who is our president, and the AFL-CIO would like to argue that this is a trade union that represents Israeli workers, It was an organization that helped build the Israeli state. And as a matter of fact, it owned its own industry and it owned strike breakers also. So when workers would go out on strike in Israel, you know, both either Israeli or Israeli and Arab, the Histadrut would break those strikes. So this is a capitalist organization. It's not even duplicitous in the sense that it's dual, like the AFL-CIO is, you know, while it prevents workers from, you know, organizing, essentially it also helps to negotiate contracts. That's not the case. The Histadrut is not any way, shape, or form a labor organization that supports, it certainly doesn't support the Arab workers. The Arab workers are discriminated against. They pay dues to, and they have to be in the Histadrut, and they pay dues to the Histadrut, but they are not represented in any way, shape, or form by the Histadrut. Let me just step back. Theodore Herzl, who was the theorist of Zionism, basically argued that the British Empire and the West in general was going to have to help Israel develop itself as a state within the Middle East because of the fact that right from the very beginning, Herzl promised to do the bidding of the West. And so Winston Churchill said, a Jewish state under the protection of the British crown would from every point of view be beneficial and would be especially in harmony with the truest interests of the British Empire. So this is the final colonial settler state. It is decided, it is stated, everybody understands that. There's nothing supportable about the history drit, and yet people like Liz Schuller and the head of the AFT, Weingarten, who's my president, essentially everybody has agreed that in the necessity of keeping the history and keeping the Israeli state, because the Israeli state had historically done the bidding of the West. And, you know, the United States uses Israel in order to invade other countries. It you know, besides the fact that, you know, it supplies arms and weapons to Israel, it also essentially uses Israel as a base. So when it wanted to attack Iraq, it used Israel in order to be able to do that. Herzl says, he's the founding father of Zionism, said, we should there form a portion of a rampart of Europe against Asia. This is another indication of a colonial settler state. So it's not like we want to be with those people. We are bringing in the West, and the West is going to have to defend us because we're defending the interests of the West. As an outpost of civilization, as opposed to barbarism, just clear out unadulterated racism. We should, as a natural state, remain in contact with all Europe, which would have to guarantee our existence. This is a clear statement that hand in glove, Israel has determined, or that what became the Israeli state has become an outpost, essentially, of imperialism. The history of Jewry is an arm of the ruling class. It has no independence whatsoever. It helped build the Israeli state. Without the history drut, it's unlikely, according to the founders of Ben Gurion and people like that, that it would be unlikely that the Israeli state would be able to get off the ground. So Tony Greenstein is, and I have to say that, I mean, he has helped enormously in terms of unearthing the kinds of things that the history drut has done and the claims that they have made over the, from their inception. I would suggest people, I think he has a book coming out. It's worth actually taking a look at. He says about Golda Meir in 1928, she says, I was put on the History of Jewry Executive Committee at a time when this big labor union wasn't just a trade union organization. It was a great colonizing agency. Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, contended that without the History of Jewry, I doubt whether we would have had a state. Therefore, not only should the AFL break with the History of Jewry, but because here is an organization that continues to condone the genocide. The History of Jewry is not a labor union as much as it pretends to be. And it was an arm of the Israeli state. It has its own businesses. It's not a typical trade union. It's almost like Mussolini and fascist unions. Under Mussolini and under Hitler, they had their labor leader who would represent them in the state, but essentially all kinds of strikes were essentially outlawed under fascism. And if anybody knows anything about the history of the Zionists, they look to Mussolini, especially Mussolini, because they argued that Mussolini wasn't a racist, unlike the Nazis, who were racist and hated Jews. But they saw them as a strong-armed military force, and that they admired them and did not oppose fascism. They saw themselves as organizing essentially a fascist state within the Middle East, modeled on the type that Mussolini had organized in Italy. So as I said, the History Jewish helped organize strike breakers. So whenever even Israeli workers would go out on strike, or when Israeli and Arab workers initially would go out on strike together, the Histadrut would break those strikes. The Histadrut was the owner of 25% of the capitalist industries, which, as I said, often employed strike breakers, so that there was impossible to have any sort of independent activity. And especially since the Histadrut, who, you know, modeled itself as being some trade union leadership, essentially, you know, called all the shots when it came to workers, either Arab or Arab and Jew, going out on strike. That the Histadrut had played nefarious roles in all kinds of countries, helping American imperialism put down struggles. In 1958, the International Institute for Development, Coordination, and Labor Studies was established as a means of furthering Western interests in the Third World. Half of its graduates came from the Asian Institute for Labor Studies and Cooperation, funded by the CIA through the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO obviously has, you know, its own nefarious history all along, but the AFL-CIO and the Histadrut has worked hand in glove together in supporting all of these CIA ventures, especially in the Third World. It operated on behalf of the U.S. in African countries such as Zaire and Kenya, and thus the AFL, the Israel, had essentially carried out American foreign policy and helping to shape American foreign policy, because in the beginning, Theodor Herzl, who was the founding father of Zionism, said that the West will have to comply and will have to protect Israel, because they know that Israel is going to protect the interests of the West. And so right from the jump, there was this symbiotic relationship between the State of Israel, the Histadrut, which was, you know, essentially had been an arm and a state builder of the Israeli economy, and American imperialism. Greenstein says that ISCOR, which was a steel company, was owned 51% by the Histadrut and 49% by South Africa, so that the Histadrut helped build the machinery of the South African government in order to maintain and prop up. And remember, this is the same period. The Israel becomes a state in 1948, and the apartheid state becomes established in South Africa in 1948 as well. So 49% was owned by the South African corporation, and South Africa was, their armed forces were managed to get the steel from both, not only from their own country, from South Africa, but also from Israel, which helped to put down any insurgent movements in South Africa.
That was Professor Carol Lang speaking at a panel held by the Labor Education Project on AFL-CIO International Operations on May 4th, 2024.
Genocide, it's a genocide. Yo, all they do is lie about Palestine. Dehumanized lives, justify war crimes. 75 years of occupation, now it's extermination. Ooh, we live on our news feeds, a Holocaust in real time, and some are talking both sides. Opinions left and right, while children are left to die from war to rockets. It's a racket that stabilized the debt market. Ask a million dead Iraqis. Pregúntale a los palestinos, a los sirios. A los hijos de los desaparecidos. Ask the mother of the child bombed to smithereens. Ask the man who lost his fam to the military machine. Green back, backed up by the arms industry. Best believe, blow back or go beyond the Middle East. Hit the streets of America, ka, ka, ka. Sunsets on the empire, ojalá, yeah.
Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide, it's a genocide. Genocide.
That was Rebel Diaz, 1-800-GENOCIDE. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. In a recent victory for the medical freedom movement, the World Health Organization failed to adopt a global pandemic treaty. The proposed treaty, according to its detractors, would centralize control over state agencies, pandemic responses, and other health matters. Mitchell Cohen of WBAI Pacifica Radio spoke to Dr. Meryl Nass at the Medical Freedom Rally at the United Nations in New York City on Saturday, May 25th, 2024.
I'm standing here at the UN with Dr. Meryl Nass, who's been fighting against the WHO.
The WHO, since its inception in 1948, has been an advisory body that provided recommendations and basically provided charity and helped the health systems of underdeveloped nations. And it did that for 75 years, but 2 years ago it was discovered by globalists that it was a cheap date and it could be taken over. It has a budget of less than $4 billion a year. 85% of that comes from donations. So its funders actually now, through public-private partnerships, run 75% of the programming of the WHO. And they, in conjunction with pliable leaders of nations, including Joe Biden of the US, decided to create massive amendments to an existing treaty called the International Health Regulations, and to create a new document called the Pandemic Treaty or Pandemic Agreement. And these documents would then centralize control of public health during emergencies within the WHO and allow the Director General to issue orders that would have to be obeyed by the 194 member states of the WHO.
For most people, when they think of WHO, think that it's a benevolent health organization that's trying to protect everybody in the world.
Yes, and it absolutely was. But beginning about 20, 25 years ago, it slowly was converted into an organization that was taking in most of its money from donors, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Wellcome Trust, Rockefeller Fund, pharmaceutical companies, etc. And 85% of its budget comes from these donors. So the organization transformed into a public-private partnership, and now it is transforming again in an attempt to become the global governor of healthcare. Now, the way it accomplished this is, as we saw during COVID, there was already control of national governments in most of the Western world, who all went lockstep with the same rules, regulations, and restrictions throughout Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the UK, as well as the US. None of them were allowed to use hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. All of them were recommending remdesivir, ventilators, and vaccines. And the vaccines were massively promoted, even though it was known within 2 months of the rollout that they did not work. And after about 6 months, they make you more susceptible to COVID. In addition, they cause myocarditis, heart attacks, and blood clots, as well as winding up in all the organs of your body. So the spike protein can go anywhere and damage the blood vessels to any organ, causing organ failure or other problems. The WHO was behind the promotion of all of these policies and continues to stand by them today. What has happened is that our national governments, the mainstream media, and the WHO have lied and misrepresented what is in the documents. That is the only way they could get people to accept them. And our own elected officials were given bullet point papers that lied about what was in the documents because nobody wants to read 90 pages of legalese. However, finally, I and others have been reading it. We've been interpreting it. We've been showing screenshots. We've been showing people what's really in these documents, what the true intention of the WHO and its funders is. And finally, 49 U.S. senators, 24 U.S. governors, and 22 attorneys general, all Republicans, because they were the easier ones to get to, have said no, they will not comply. The senators demand that these treaties be put before the Senate for ratification, where they will fail because they require a two-thirds vote. And the governors and the attorneys general have said they will not enforce the WHO's orders in their state, and the WHO has no jurisdiction whatsoever in their states. This is critically important. That message got out to the rest of the world, and people started saying, wow, if all of these American politicians say there's a big problem and that this is a sovereignty grab, maybe what we thought was in these documents isn't really true. They started reading them. They realized what we're saying here in the U.S. is fact. And now the nations around the world are suddenly saying, no, they're not able to go along. And as of yesterday, the negotiating teams for both the amendments to the health regulations and the new pandemic treaty have failed. Neither team of negotiators has been able to come up with a document. So for the moment, we are out of the woods. The bureaucrats at the WHO are likely to try to create some new document and then get everyone to say okay to and call some sort of victory. But we have won and they have lost. What we have to do, though, is watch, because the globalists who are seeking world governance are not going to stop with this. They're moving on to the UN, which is right across the street from us. In September, the UN Secretary General is asking the General Assembly to agree to giving him the right to call global shock emergencies whenever he wishes and then tell the world how they have to behave when he declares one. This is an identical program as what the WHO was trying to do. The idea was you won't know what's in the emergency platform document. You sign it now, you'll find out later what's in it. And there are no standards that would limit the Secretary General from declaring anything a global shock.
Well, we know, though, that if rulers of the United States want something, they'll find some other way of making it happen. What do you suspect? How will the WHO and the others maneuver in order to get this through?
The maneuvering always takes place behind closed doors. You know, there's always bribery, threats. We don't know what's going to happen. What we do know is the African bloc of 54 nations usually hangs together, and they've been told to hang together on this. There was really nothing very useful for them in the documents, and so they've said no. And if you've got a bloc of 54 countries saying no, it's really hard to get past that. We've also got 15 or 16 countries that have already said they're not going along. Unfortunately, leaders from two of those countries were attacked or perhaps had accidents. One was shot multiple times, the Prime Minister of Slovakia, who had said he wasn't going along with either document at the WHO. He was shot a little over a week ago. And the Foreign Minister and the President of Iran just had a helicopter crash and are both dead. Those were two countries that had said no. I've advised heads of state not to make their choice known in advance, but to absolutely, when it comes, or if it comes to a vote, because the WHO bureaucracy does not like votes, they like to claim consensus. But if there's a vote, it's very necessary to stand up and say no, and don't let them claim a false consensus.
What do you think that people here, there's people in the U.S., can do about this?
What we have to do first is turn off NPR, the New York Times, and all the mainstream media, and find alternative media that are telling you the truth. Unfortunately, even though nobody likes to read these documents, it's necessary. At least read the screenshots, find out what's true, verify it yourself, know what's true, and share it with everybody you know, because this is an attempt to take away our freedoms, to destroy the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and we've got to fight back. This isn't going to be the end of the road, but it looks like we've won the first battle.
That was WBAI Pacifica's Mitchell Cohen speaking to Dr. Meryl Nass at the Medical Freedom Rally at the United Nations on May 25th. That was The Who. Who are you? This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Next, Dr. Peter McCullough spoke to rapid-fire interviewer Joe Pags about the history of COVID-19, the potential threat of avian bird flu, and the corruption and conflicts of interest at the heart of the COVID pandemic that resulted in, quote-unquote, vaccine ideology.
It's Dr. Peter McCullough, MD, MPH, FACC, FAHA. I could go on for an hour and a half, Doc, but you are a world-renowned cardiologist, and it's always a pleasure to have you back on, my friend. How are you?
Great, thank you.
Really glad to have you back. Go to PeterMcCulloughMD.com. Support everything he does. He's shadow banned everywhere, which means he's telling the truth. So go and try to follow him on all the social media as well. Let's jump right into it. H5N1. I know that there was an H2N1 and H3N1. I guess we're up to five now. Is this something we should worry about, Doc?
It is. It could be disease X, Joe. H5 means it's avian, and then it can be N in different configurations. The H is the hemagglutinin. That's the spike protein on influenza. It's been around for, you know, decades. The Chinese have made it much worse by vaccinating poultry because the vaccines in poultry don't work. And so the birds spread it around more. The French tried it last year. It made it worse. Now we've had one case. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine today of a man in West Texas, conjunctivitis. He got it either handling some form of livestock, bird or cattle. And the bottom line is, I think this is going to be a much bigger threat to poultry and potentially livestock then it will be humans. It doesn't spread to humans very well at all, but we could be facing mass culling of poultry and potentially cattle. That's going to put constraints on the food supply.
I wanted to ask you about that specifically because you and I think, agree. I know we agree that the COVID came from the lab. It wasn't from a pangolin at some wet market somewhere in China. It looks like it came from the lab. They wanted us to believe that it would go from an animal to a bat bit the animal, then the bat bit somebody who kissed somebody else. None of that really seemed to make any sense. So in a very simple, very general term, can viruses, diseases, can things that can kill humans literally go from an animal to a human being just through natural living?
Well, there are zoonoses, but in this one, Joe, this one looks like another gain of function laboratory product. The specific strain that we're tracking looks like it came out of the USDA poultry lab in Athens, Georgia, where the director of the lab is a former Gates Foundation scientist. Wow. So you can't make this up.
We, for millennia, human beings on Earth, lived without having all these injections and mRNA, this and that, and gain-of-function research. Doc, why are they messing with the food supply? Are we at some risk if they don't mess with the food supply? Why not leave it alone?
Well, I certainly can observe. Bird flu does have some mortality in animals, but in my opinion, it'd be much better off to have the animals develop natural resistance as opposed to the vaccines promoting more and more resistant strains.
I'm glad you went to natural resistance because that's something you and I have talked about for years now. That literally was not allowed by the CDC, the FDA, the NIH. They didn't want us to naturally build up a resistance or an immunity to COVID. They wanted us to get it through the shots that they were forcing on everybody. And again, if we go back to some of our earliest conversations, you were of the mindset that human beings have a really great ability to fight off disease if you let us do it, right?
It's true. You know, natural immunity cannot be beat. You know, the CDC is meeting right now to decide on the 10th shot, to decide on what the new booster is going to be. Who could have possibly envisioned 10 shots, nonstop, every 6 month genetic vaccination? It appears as if the world's lost its mind.
Well, they've made it clear they want this to be an every 6 month, as you said, or every year vaccination, like the flu vaccination. By the way, I don't get a flu shot either. I don't get any of that stuff. I'm still young, healthy enough. I work out. I eat right. And I think that naturally God gave us these bodies, or nature gave us these bodies, that will fight off much. Now, look, there's always a place for medicine. I'm not saying that there isn't. Mm-hmm. But to force this stuff where we don't even have informed consent never made any sense to begin with. Is it your opinion that they've always wanted to make this a twice a year or once a year shot?
You know, there's been a lot of signaling that, you know, this would be on a routine schedule, but the COVID vaccines only last a few months. So there's no way they could be annual. If they're ever going to be given, it's going to be every 6 months. But 97% of Americans have immunity. We've been through this, Joe. You know, no special protections are needed now. We can treat even the most severe cases if they occur. You know, this is vaccine ideology. This is now like a religious belief. It's not driven by science or data.
We've talked about the vaccines from the beginning, and early on, almost across the board, people said, well, it might help some people. Maybe it'll help the elderly. Maybe it'll help this section of people. As of today, with all the research that you've seen, all the studies that you've seen, all the stuff that you can rattle off from the top of your head, if you were to go retrospectively, should anybody ever have gotten these vaccines?
Now, I think they were never safe enough to broadly administer. You know, early on, they did reduce some, you know, the binary COVID-19 illness that occurred basically in the community, no reductions in hospitalization and death, no prevention of transmission. And once we got into the boosters, they were just tested on animals, no human data. All the non-randomized studies, Joe, are biased. They're using all kinds of methods to create an illusion that the vaccines worked when indeed they failed.
When they said it stopped transmission, they didn't know that, right? Pfizer never, literally never tested to see if it stopped transmission.
That's right. These are false claims. And in fact, the European Parliament questioning one of the Pfizer executives, they said, no, of course we didn't test transmission. Our CDC director came out in the summer of 2021 and said the vaccines don't stop transmission. And then it turns out sports teams, military, and then HHS for healthcare, they mandated vaccines after they knew they didn't stop transmission.
Is it your thought, this is just asking for opinion, but is it your thought they did that because the federal government already invested all the money in buying the vaccines?
That could be a good point. You know, these were all pre-purchased products, and they were unconditional purchases. The vaccines failed. There should have been mechanisms to return the products. They may not be popular, and they're not. We know that in Canada, Europe, there's been a mass return of vials. People aren't taking the boosters, but yet the companies had pre-purchased contract agreements.
But if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And if you lose the money, you lose the money. You save lives by not forcing it on people. Is it your belief that these should be pulled off the market, period? They're just not safe?
Well, sure. I came out in 2022. U.S. Senate, Joe, is on the record. I called for removal of all the COVID-19 vaccines off the market. I'm in line with the World Council for Health internationally, Association of American Physicians and Surgeons here in the United States, and Surgeon General Joe Ladapo, MD, PhD, Harvard-trained physician, as well as now several hundred elected representatives all calling for the COVID-19 vaccines to be removed from the market. They're not safe for human use.
You said something a little while ago that the vaccine doesn't last very long, just a few months, so you'd have to do it every 6 months if they want to try to force this and pretend like it's going to be helping people. Again, you're not saying anybody should get it at all, but they'd have to have it on a every few months or every 6 month schedule to make it effective in the eyes of what they're advertising to people. Having said that, if it wears off after every few months, why are we talking about things like spike support? Why are we talking about sort of cleaning out the spike proteins that are in there? Are there residual effects if you've only gotten one shot or two shots and never get another one?
There are. We're seeing now late blood clots and cardiac arrests, you know, years after the shots. I testified in Congress, Joe, January 2024. I cited the FDA guidance. You know, we need to be concerned for 5 to 15 years after the last shot because these are genetic products. The messenger RNA is long lasting. The spike protein, even more long lasting. With all these injections, so many people are loaded with the Wuhan spike protein. This is the spine on the surface of the virus. It goes everywhere in the body. It causes heart damage, brain damage, causes blood clots, immunologic problems, may cause cancer. And so it is imperative that we consider a platform of base spike detoxification. I was the first to publish that. Two peer-reviewed papers now offered and available to people.
What's interesting to me is that, again, people, every time they hear you speak, when I have people like you on and you specifically on, we get attacked roundly. What do you think that is? Is there a bit of this mass psychosis that we've talked about a lot, where people just buy into it because a government agency said so, it must be so, they've got to be looking out for our best interest? Or is there something else going on, do you think?
No, I think it's an ideology. It's like a religion. And it's so hard for people to face the truth. I mean, we all wanted the vaccines to be safe and effective. It turns out they weren't. And people are now having an impossible time reconciling what's happened. To make matters worse, most people took them. And now we're seeing mass levels of side effects and, sadly, fatalities. A Rasmussen survey, January of 2024, 53% of Americans think the vaccines are causing side effects leading to large numbers of deaths. Joe, that's huge. That's more than half the population.
Doc, in your career as a cardiologist, have you ever seen so many young people have cardiac issues, die suddenly from cardiac arrest? I mean, we're seeing athletes, the top echelon, the top 1% of all athletic people and performers on the planet, some of them just dying. Have you ever seen that before?
Never have. And the peer-reviewed deaths published in the literature, first one by Verma, New England Journal of Medicine in 2021, then Choi in Korea, and the list goes on and on. These are young, healthy people that either die during sports or activities, or they die in bed between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. Both times there's a surge of adrenaline, and when there's heart inflammation or myocarditis, it triggers a cardiac arrest.
Is there a reason why some people get vaccinated? The response I'll get is, I got vaccinated and didn't have any problems. And I'll say, well, not everybody does. Is there a reason why it affects some severely and some don't get any effects at all?
Well, the data we have in the United States from the CDC V-safe data is about 7.7% of Americans really got sick with the vaccines. So it's great. Sure, there's a lot of people who took the vaccines and they're fine. The batches probably matter. Paper by Schmeling and colleagues, 30% of people have zero side effects. About 60% have some modest side effects. And in that study, it was 4.2% that are in trouble. So we're looking between 5 and 10% of people are really in trouble with these vaccines. And when it's applied to the entire country, it's an unacceptably high number of people with vaccine injuries, disabilities, and sadly, deaths.
When it comes to the vaccines as well, are there actual studies now showing a relationship to psychosis, maybe cancer, maybe autoimmune disease?
There's over 4,000 papers. And Joe, my estimate is that's only 1% of reality because there's such a bias against publishing any papers showing vaccine side effects. But there's fully 4,000 peer-reviewed papers describing vaccine injuries, disabilities, and deaths. And yes, acute psychosis is one of them, progressive loss of cognitive function. This may be dose-related, and that the more doses people take, the more disease they develop.
And people need to heed these warnings because I think you and I talked about this before. There are a lot of people who have done these studies and a lot of organizations that have done these studies that frankly were afraid to publish what they found out because they would be canceled. You aren't afraid of being canceled. There are several others that I have on all the time that are not afraid of being canceled because you want the truth to be out there and you want to help people. But there are some, I mean, would you agree there are a lot out there that knew about these a long time ago, knew about the results and the studies and the side effects a long time ago that were frankly scared into not saying anything?
Well, sure, it's coming out on Capitol Hill. The CDC knew early on. All kinds of NIH officials knew early on. And it was concealed from the public. Probably the worst example of this is Pfizer had 1,223 deaths within 90 days of release of their vaccine. They recorded all of them. And both Pfizer and the FDA blocked that report to America for over a year. And they were pushing for 55 years of concealment as opposed to coming clean on what happened. So the FDA and Pfizer are colluding to block Americans from learning the truth.
It is Dr. Peter McCullough. Doc, have you had an opinion on members of the government going from places like the FDA or the CDC to Pfizer, to Moderna, and then from Moderna or Pfizer into government authority where they get to make decisions?
Right. Well, in my book, Courage to Face COVID-19, we define the biopharmaceutical complex, and that's it. People are working for their next jobs. 9 out of the last 10 FDA commissioners, various consulting or venture capital firms, where their actions in office will affect their future employment with these companies. The conflict of interest right now is out of control. The corruption is wide open. It's got to stop.
What happened to the whole theory of informed consent? I thought after World War II, the Globe said you cannot be forced to take any sort of medication for loss of job, for persecution, for religious beliefs, whatever. After what we saw them do in Germany, the Nazis do to the world back then, what happened to that? Did that just go out the window?
That was the first tenet of the Nuremberg Code. It says no one, under any conditions, can receive any pressure, coercion, or threat of reprisal for either taking or not taking a product, in this case, the vaccine. So our human rights were trampled upon. The Declaration of Helsinki outlines that we should have free, full, fair, informed consent. That wasn't done. You know, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, that's an organization I probably belong to, they opposed mandates of any kind by resolution in 2000. That was 24 years ago. They saw this coming and said no one should be mandated to take any pill or injection.
Dr. Peter McCullough, go to petermcculloughmd.com. Also go to linktree.com/JoePags. Click on the wellness company, read up on all the literature and information there. Make sure that you're safe. Maybe 20 seconds on this, Doc. Is there a reason, any reason that you can think of medically why we would have to have mRNA in our food injected into beef, injected into poultry? We keep on hearing that it's going to be happening. Any reason why that should be happening?
It's completely unnecessary. Conventional vaccines in swine and cattle work fine.
That was Dr. Peter McCullough speaking to Joe Pags. CRD producer Thomas O'Rourke transcribed and edited the interview from Dr. McCullough's Substack. A complete transcript can be found on our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Akua Holt, J.R. Valray, Thomas O'Rourke, Mitchell Cohn, Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.